So first and foremost, I'd like it if we could spend a little bit of time together sharing what your experience was in doing the four elements meditation. You know, how did you find it to be different from doing inside practice? Were there any similarities? Just a little few reflections or thoughts or questions that you might have about the actual doing of this practice. So, inquiring minds want to know.
How long have you been doing this practice?
About 20 years. I took it up at the same time that I took up the practice of the jhanas, the meditative absorptions, because I found it to be a very effective way to rather quickly get the mind to a pretty deep state of samadhi. And I do it every morning usually try to practice as early as I can in the morning, because it provides a little bit of insight into what the mind's up to going forward in terms of, you know, how you might take in the day. And about 80% of the time when the mind's left to its own devices, it gets off into planning. And so when I first sit down, it's really important for me to get as grounded in the present moment as I possibly can. And so I nearly always start off with doing the four, and sometimes I'll do it for the whole set, sometimes for just until I can, you know, like Ajahn Chah says, until the silt settles to the bottom of the pond, you know, and the mind becomes clear and able to kind of see clearly what's going on. But it's become an integral part of my practice, yeah. And the more you do it, you know, the more powerful it becomes, right? So, please. Yes.
Focus more. And when it was just elements, you know, I just kept following it. But then when you changed it so that it was grounding and vibration and flowing and breathing, it seemed to go deeper to another level.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Thank you. That distinction. And it's that shift in language, but it also seems to bring about a shift in the way we experience what's going on. Because when we call these things nouns, you know, earth, water, fire, and air, you know, they become objects. When we switch instead to using gerunds, processes, those words actually are much closer to what the subatomic physicists tell us we really are, which essentially is not things, is not mass, that we are basically a basket of light. You know, when you get down past the level of appearances of there being solidity and things and whatnot, we come to find that we are basically nothing more than a temporary gathering of certain processes that are going on, you know, whether it's the blood and the and flowing through the circulatory system and the other fluids that are always flowing through the body, keeping us going, the cohesion of being in this fathom-long sack of flesh, you know, the processes that keep us alive, that keep us in touch, you know. We are basically gerunds. We are a collection of processes more than we are things, you know. And when we can experience ourselves in that way, it can have the effect of making things feel a little more porous, you know, a little lighter, a little less dense, a little more aware of the fact that we, you know, in the sort of the Taoist sense, you know, that we are part of an ongoing flow, you know, and we're here in this particular form for this period of time. But in fact, when we really check into what literally is going on insofar as our existence here in this earth in relationship to everybody else and everything else, just like everybody else and everything else. We are essentially a flow of processes. And so attending to our sensations, you know, of what it feels like to be alive in the environment, it seems that we are actually getting perhaps a little closer to the reality of that experience, you know, on the microscopic and submicroscopic level. Thank you. Please, anything else?
Isn't the human body about two-thirds water?
About two-thirds, yeah, right. And furthermore, it's being born and dying. I think what we, about 700,000 cells per second are being born and dying in the body all the time. Different organs of the body, different structures of the body replicate themselves at different rates, okay? But on average, the human body completely replicates itself every 7 years. So we are this process. We are this continuous process of arising and changing and passing away until at some point, at least physically, we cease to arise. So, anything else? Very well. I brought a sort of a larger version of the Buddha that is on the altar here tonight. It's one of my favorite images. It's the Buddha that's usually referred to as calling Earth to witness. Calling Earth to witness the moment of his attainment of freedom, his moment of enlightenment. Okay. And a little like Jesus of Nazareth going off into the desert and having his struggles and his encounters with the wicked one, the stories of the Buddha leading up to his moment of the attainment of nirvana are somewhat the same. And there is this mythic figure that he talks about a lot in his discourses, and the figure of Mara, you know, the tormentor, or sometimes referred to as the evil one, or the tempter. Different ways to understand that, you know, whether you understand that, you know, and certainly in his time, most people did understand that to be actually a non-corporeal entity that would show up and make trouble until the Buddha would kind of see what he is up to and says, "I see you, Mara," and then Mara would slink off into the shadows again. Another way to understand this figure of Mara in Buddhist literature and teachings is that it's the Buddha's shadow self. That in fact, it was that element of his own consciousness that was tormenting him right up until the moment of enlightenment. So as he describes the four quarters of the night, you know, the hours leading up to the achievement of nirvana, sort of the heroic struggle that he was undergoing. Okay. There are these stories, these passages where he talks about the various forces that Mara sends against him, you know. And sometimes they're powerful, frightening, aversive forces. Sometimes they are tantalizing visions, designed, you know, of women and food and whatnot, designed to keep him connected to sense desires, okay. Or to fall into an energy less inert state. Or the final one, okay, is the one where Mara challenges him to say, "Who are you? Who are you to set yourself up on a pedestal? Who are you to presume that you have something to teach others?" Another way to understand those forces that arose in the form of Mara is that what the Buddha was doing was experiencing extraordinary, powerful versions of the hindrances. Very powerful aversion. very powerful desire. And the final one was doubt. When Mara challenges him, who are you? Who are you to be a spiritual teacher? Who are you to presume to tell others how things are? Who are you to presume to point to the possibility of enlightenment? Okay. By what authority do you presume to teach? And it was at that moment in time that the Buddha touched the earth. It is by the authority of all sentient beings, because my path leads to the cessation of suffering for all sentient beings. And it is on their behalf. It is by virtue of my commitment to the cessation of their suffering that I teach. That I am not separate from all creation. That I am neither above nor below anyone. I am of that which surrounds us. Not separate. Not apart. Okay. And so that touching of the earth was the moment that the construct of self ceased to have control over his consciousness. It dissipated for good. Okay. So that experience of anatta that lasted for the rest of his life was by virtue of getting in touch with that which is. By teaching that he is not separate from the all which is around, that he is here to bring about the cessation of suffering for all sentient beings, and therefore not apart, not separate. And it's by the authority of bringing about the cessation of suffering that he decides to go forward. It's a really important gesture, isn't it? You know, it was his getting in touch with, his saying, I'm not different than that. We are all everything. We are not separate. Okay? So that's also why he taught the four elements, you know, the first foundation of mindfulness. He said, when you go to do this practice, if you start off stuck in your head and you stay stuck in your head, you're not going to really go anywhere. You're not going to make any progress. You have to come home to the body. You have to realize that this is ultimately all we are. Not separate, not apart. That we are of that which is around us. We are not different from it. So he wanted to start helping us train the mind to live in this truth. Okay? For this to be how we understand ourselves to be in the world. And he taught the four elements practice, he said, both internally and externally. What he meant by externally is that whenever you go out into the world, just as you feel the water element in your mouth, you feel the flowing, see if you can notice the water element in your environment, whether it's in the clouds or if you're by a stream or somewhere. If there's no evident water, anything that's green is filled with water. It's green because it's doing photosynthesis, which requires water. So it's drawing water into itself to do that process. Okay. If you are outside and you feel the breeze, okay, the air element, you know, if you're hanging out with the trees are breathing just like you are. If the trees didn't breathe, we couldn't either, right? So it's that exchange, that sense of connection with through the medium of air and space. Okay. So one of the ways that, for me, renewal happens and rejuvenation and energizing is to spend a certain amount of time whenever I can in a natural setting. So it's possible to really, you know, do this practice in some depth out of doors. So if you're going for a hike, I imagine a lot of you may do this already. If you go out for a day hike somewhere, if you take along like an inflatable cushion or blankets or something, and you find a sort of a secluded place where you can get off the trail and sit and practice for a little while, really recommend doing this four elements practice in a natural setting like that. It can be way trippy because the mind gets so settled in that you just really do, you know, it's like in the old Star Trek movies. They say, beam me up, Scotty, you know, and you all these little points of light and whatnot, and you can really just feel yourself kind of soften into that which is around you. I recommend it. And like I was saying a little bit earlier, deeply practiced, you know, and I recommend, you know, if you can find a time to do this for an extended period, you know, like 45 minutes or an hour or something like that, you might, with a little practice, you might find that your samadhi just gets deeper, that you just find the mind able to relax into states of softness and silence and stillness that maybe hadn't been so much a part of your practice before. So it's really worth taking up. And practice at that depth over a period of time. It can indeed begin to have the effect of softening the boundaries of self. You know, in the Greater Discourse on the Establishing of Mindfulness, where the Buddha talks about, you know, mindfulness of mind. It says, knows the contracted mind to be the contracted mind. You know, knows the dull mind to be the dull mind. Knows the expanded mind to be the expanded mind. Okay, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about relaxing the mind to the point where the discursive mind is no longer creating self, or at least it's not actively doing so. Sort of in abeyance or taking a nap or on a short sabbatical. And lo and behold, there is this sense of opening and this sense of kind of connection, of oneness with the things that are around you. All that being said, okay, practiced at that level, it causes us to become more sentient beings than we were before. Because we're more sensitized to what it's like just to be in this body, what it's like to be alive. We're more sensitized to what in Chinese Dharma they call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. We're more sensitized to the joy of being alive in the body. And we're also more sensitized to the fact that we may have digestive problems or a bad knee or a tight neck or whatever other sensations in the body we might judge to be unpleasant, right? It's like opening to everything. Okay. And we also know that if we don't open to it all, ultimately we can't open to any of it. You know, it's not just the good stuff. If we want to really open to the full experience of being alive, it means sort of taking it all in. Okay. And to the extent that we try to filter out, you know, to only scoop up the good stuff and try to ignore everything else, it creates this division in us, doesn't it? That causes us to really start to censor experience and in some cases live less of a life than we might otherwise be doing, you know. There's a Spanish gypsy proverb that says, a life lived in fear is a life half lived. You know, gotta open to the unpleasant. The Sufi teacher, Pir Velayat Khan, sort of put it this way. He said, overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each one of us is part of her heart and therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. You are sharing in the totality of that pain and you are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. So, comes with the territory, right? Part of the process of being alive. You know, to be fully in the moment, to fully acknowledge our mortality, right? To really savor the fullness of the moment means taking it all in, leaving nothing out, leaving no one out of the heart. So in my work, environmental work for the Colorado Sierra Club, I've found that this teaching about connection and oneness to be absolutely crucial to the work that I do. The other thing that I have found to be absolutely necessary is to do frequent and ongoing practice of the Brahmaviharas, you know, of the cultivation of compassion for myself and others, for opening to selfless joy, something that the Dalai Lama calls our birthright, opening to states of stillness and equanimity, opening to open-heartedness, to boundlessness. The reason that that has become kind of a challenge for me is the nature of the work that I do is with, for the most part, populations of people who have been historically disadvantaged, okay, by virtue of ethnicity or socioeconomic status or religion sometimes, okay, and whose environments threaten their very well-being, where there have been government decisions taken that place them in harm's way insofar as threats to their health and well-being, and especially that of their children. So some of the cases we're working on now involve the expansion of highway Interstate I-70 going through low-income minority neighborhoods in North Denver. It includes cases like the people of Greeley and Weld County successfully stopping a large oil and gas operation from being built quite near an upper middle class white middle school, and so they relocated it to a low income minority school where the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Committee permitted the firm to go ahead and build this thing, okay, within a few hundred feet of an elementary school. We're finding benzene in the public schools along I-70, occasioned by highway traffic, also occasioned by the fact that the Colorado Public Department of Public Health and Environment just gave the Suncor refinery permission to start emitting hydrogen cyanide from the refinery in order for them to be able to crack the Athabascan tar sands that Suncor also owns. Yes, that's the same gas we used to use to kill prisoners with in state penitentiaries. It's the same gas the Nazis used in the Holocaust. Okay, and it's being emitted into the air in North Denver in southern Adams County. Okay, so these are decisions made by government agencies who ostensibly have the responsibility to protect the health and well-being of these people who aren't doing it. And in some ways, it's kind of heartbreaking work. You know, the kids that live in the Glovelle area and Swansea neighborhoods have a 40% higher rate of childhood asthma emergency room admissions than any other neighborhood in the city. The residents there have a 70% higher rate of congestive heart disease. Okay. Both of those conditions are directly attributable to highway exhaust, to refinery emissions, the power plant emissions. Okay. The Garden Place Elementary School in the Globeville neighborhood, one of the parents who does environmental testing for a living recently tested the air there. He found 5 parts per billion of benzene, which is a known carcinogen. Side effect, or you know, it comes from refining and combustion of fossil fuels. It's known to cause childhood leukemia at fairly low levels of concentration. And so he brought this to the attention of Denver Public Schools, and they did some sampling, and then the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment also came out and did some sampling. And they found 5 parts per billion of benzene in the ambient air outside the school. And they said, well, we're really sorry that your kids are being poisoned by benzene, but, you know, the air is just as crappy outside as it is inside your building, right? So, sorry. But for the parents, that's not good enough, you know. And they're speaking up. We're speaking up. We're in court, and we're in administrative proceedings and whatnot. For me, having lived most of my life pretending not to know what's going on in those neighborhoods and others like them, and to go there now and to work there frequently now is painful, because I can see how these people are being afflicted by things that we know how to stop, and yet we're not. It's really easy to go out into, you know, a park or up into the mountains and do the four elements meditation practice, you know. It's quite another to do that practice in the Globeville neighborhood when you're aware that the air you're breathing has about 5 parts per billion of benzene in it. Okay. It's a little harder to open up to that and feel, you know, oneness with that. At a meeting of a professional group that I was active in, the Law and Society Association, a few years ago, we had a panel where we were looking at environmental justice issues and what the law has to say and whatnot. And there was a professor there from Tulane University, which is down in Louisiana, and he talked about how when... And he was very active in these causes, you know, these litigation and whatnot. And he talked about when he would have friends come to visit him who were environmental law professors or environmental activists from other parts of the country, come down to visit him. He would take them, say, well, let's go out for a canoe trip. And they say, yeah, right, you know, we go out and look at the wildlife and, you know, get into the, you know, into the some of the backcountry a little bit by water and really see what's going on there. Instead, he would take them up these inlets off the Mississippi River near the port of New Orleans. And so they would go back up into these, you know, these creeks and waterways, and there'd be some wildlife and whatnot, but there are also these great ruptured, rusting oil tanks and half-submerged ships and all of the abandoned salvage from, you know, port operations and whatnot. And then when they'd come back from their trip, his friends would say, you know, blech, what was that about? You know, I could see oil on the water that we were paddling through. Why didn't you take us out to a prettier place? And he said, well, you know, we can go to court all we want, but things are really never going to fundamentally change until we have a social movement that requires them to change. And in order to have that, we have to learn how to love scarred landscapes. We have to learn how to love damaged or scarred landscapes instead of pretending like they don't exist or simply blocking them from our view. Okay. Because those wrecked, ruptured, scarred landscapes are also places where people live who cannot afford to live anywhere else. So when we choose to ignore those, we're also choosing to ignore those people. Okay. And when I think about that, you know, it's a question of balance, just like Pir Veliot Kahn said, you know. If we are to be sentient, if we are to experience the joys of life, we also have to be ready to be open to the places that hurt, you know, the soft places, and to be ready to do something about it, you know, and this this compassion, the quivering of the heart, you know, to experience with another their suffering instead of turning away from it. You know, that's really part of this work. So, going forward, we talk in Buddha Dharma about the relative and the absolute. And I think it's really important to try to sort of keep those two in mind, you know. In this kind of work, my friend from Tulane and others, we realize there are these two words that kind of go together. One is reclamation and the other is recreation, you know. That when we go into the field, when we go out into nature, when we go hiking and whatever, we are, we do it to renew and to recreate ourselves, right? To kind of get born again into the environment, to come into the present moment, to appreciate the oneness that we share with all living things, okay? And the energy we get from that, sort of the nourishment we get from that, then we can use to turn our attention to the process of reclamation, you know, of reclaiming, of healing that which is wounded, okay? Healing that which in some ways we've either directly or indirectly played a role in wounding, and now we need to play a role in healing it. That's at the relative level, okay? At the absolute level, okay, I'm getting full circle coming back to this reflection on the four elements and genuinely being not only with that which is, but being that which is, you know. There's this well-known poem by the Vajrayana, the Tibetan meditation master, Kalu Rinpoche, you know, where he says, "You live in illusion and the appearance of things," you know. You live in the illusion of selfhood and the things that appear separate. We appear or feel ourselves to be separate from the other. You live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality, okay? But you do not know it. When you realize that this is so, you will see that you are nothing. Anatta, not self. And that being nothing, you are everything. That is all. You live in appearance, you live in delusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. You are that reality. When you realize that this is so, you will see that you are nothing, and that being nothing, you are everything. That is all. So simple. Okay. So that's why I find this practice to be meaningful and why I commend it to you. And so I'd like to use our remaining time just discussing, reflecting on, asking any questions you might have either about, you know, the practice itself or anything else that's been touched upon this evening. Please. Yes, absolutely.
Particularly to those who are, well, not particularly, but directly at those who are causing the harm. And I'm just curious on how do you handle your own anger? I don't know if you ever
wonderful, wonderful question. Thank you so much for asking it. Yes, the question is, at doing social activist work, where you're really seeing and confronting, experiencing to some extent, the suffering that's being inflicted on those who cannot protect themselves from it, by those who have the power to achieve their own ends through inflicting suffering on others. How do you avoid being consumed by anger to the point where, you know, you burn out or you become unable to do this work or it starts to feel like maybe it's even self-harming? For me, the first step is always acknowledgement. Acknowledging the anger and accepting its arising and taking responsibility for it. Absolutely. You know, there's part of me that, I mean, the reason I do litigation support instead of actually litigating is because being a good litigator, you have to be kind of like a samurai. You have to be able to channel your emotions into effective action. And sometimes, you know, I get sufficiently wrought up by, you know, the stuff I'm working with. I really need to leave it to somebody that's got kind of better handle on it than I do. Then having acknowledged the anger and realizing that it's a perfectly natural phenomenon and that to some extent it arises out of empathy, you know, a real powerful sense of injustice. You know, people shouldn't be allowed to treat each other that way. And that it really needs to come to a halt. Okay. Then after having acknowledged it, and some of the beneficial intention that arises behind it, okay. I think the tricky part then is to say, okay, you know, especially if we've done a lot of activist work, maybe before discovering Buddha Dharma or before it had played a significant role in our lives, there is this inevitable tendency for the dualism and the polarization to occur, you know, where I'm fighting the good cause and these people are my enemies because they're overcome by greed, hate, and delusion and don't deserve to live. Then comes the moment where you can realize it's almost like judo. As soon as someone gets overcome by emotion, they've lost because they made themselves vulnerable. You know, they've gone out of balance. And so, if you let your anger overcome you, or direct your actions, if you speak or act from that place of anger, then it has the effect of disempowering you. You know, I might feel at the moment like, you know, you're just out there doing, but what it's actually doing is robbing you of the ability to be effective in this situation. So then it's a matter of acknowledging that's what's going on. And then the next thing for me is to say, okay, what does Buddha Dharma bring to this? You know, is there a way of understanding or perceiving what's going on that can allow me to continue to act in this situation without being overcome by anger or bitterness? That's pure value consciousness. And then what happens is I realize that through the anger, what I'm doing is condemning the other, sort of morally condemning the other. Instead of recognizing that they are in fact acting out of, you know, some sense of greed or aversion or a choosing not to see the harm they're doing, right? And we all know what greed, hate, and aversion feel like because we feel it in here. And so when I see that that's what's going on, that's why I was saying that the Brahma Viharas are so crucial to being able to do this work, because first off, if you can send some compassion to yourself for the anger and the troubled feelings that you're having, then you can also begin to appreciate or realize that the people that are inflicting this terrible harm to some extent, live in a hell realm. You know, their perceptions, their activities are heavily influenced by aversion, by attachment, and by delusion. Okay. Unfortunately, they have the power to act on those states of mind and inflict harm on others. Okay. But it then becomes at least possible to see that whether or not it appears to be the case on the surface, at some level, to the degree they're sentient, they're living a tormented existence because they know the harm they're doing. And that at least makes it possible for me to not condemn them as the other, you know, but to realize, oh my goodness, you know, it's like when Tocqueville was here in this country in 1835 and wrote Democracy in America, when he wrote about slavery, he was among the first to recognize that, he said, the slave owners are every bit as much in bondage as their slaves. Yeah. Their souls are in bondage, and they will never be free as long as they enslave another. Same thing, you know, we lock ourselves up in our own anger and stuff. Great question, short to the point question, great long answer, but really appreciate your asking it. Okay. Anything else? Anybody else? Please. Yes. Yes. The noting is a kind of a way in, because the four elements are quite holographic. They're not separate. They all lie within each other, right? So there is fluidity, there is flowing within the body, there are these circular rivers that flow in the, you know, throughout the body. And they are driven, you know, they're driven by the pump, you know, but the fire element and the water element work together, right? Because one has to keep the other moving. You know, the blood gets very grumpy if it's not moving. It tends to cloud up and cause all kinds of terrible things to go on. So the flowing element is crucial to our existence, just as is the pulsating or the vibrating, whatever. All of it has to be contained or centered within the sanctuary, the refuge of the body, okay, the grounding with the earth. And again, just as the flowing is occurring within the body, so too is the air flowing in and out and in and out, you know, as we exchange gases with all green life and with the Suncor refinery and, you know. you can even let go, you know, it can get softer and softer and more diffuse. So you're just noting, you know, flowing, flowing, pulsating, pulsating, grounding, and just knowing that all these things are going on, they all interact with each other, they're all part of each other. So it doesn't really matter, you know. Sounds are a combination of the fire element and space. You know, it's energy moving through space. When the Buddha actually taught the six elements, when he taught space, you know, I put that in there. He said you can experience space like in your nostrils and your, you know, ears and whatnot. And you can certainly, spatially, you can see the, you know, the distance between us and objects around us. So just that kind of light sense of just playing with these things, just so we can come to recognize ourselves as this temporary collection of processes. You know, it causes us to take this whole situation, makes it a little more impersonal, you know. We just don't take it quite so, in quite such a self-referential way, you know. Yeah, good, thank you. anything else?
Can I ask just a quick question so I don't have to stop and look it up on the internet on the way home? You mentioned several times about 5 particles per billion of benzene, but you said that the toxic levels were fairly low. What's the known toxic level?
There is no known non-toxic level.
Well, there's got to be an estimated toxic level.
Zero. When there's a famous Supreme Court case from 1980, it's called the benzene decision, and it's about it was the oil workers, you know, the refinery workers union against the owners of the refineries, and they got the Occupational Health and Safety Administration on their side, and they were doing toxicity research on benzene, and there had been a level set at about 10 parts per billion or whatever. So, well, as soon as you get over that, well, then the epidemiologic data really start to kick in, and you start seeing workers getting, you know, blood cancers and things like that. It'll take out little kids. It's absolutely known to cause childhood leukemia. And so then what they're fussing about is what the safe level was, and didn't have anything to do with safety. It had to do with how much it would cost to clean up the refinery and whether it had to be done through having everyone wear masks when they were in this area around this gas that kills people, or whether they should try to re-engineer the plant so that not so much of it was escaping. And so essentially the outcome of that case was that the court wasn't too keen on allowing OSHA to stand with the 10 parts per billion. They wanted to take it lower than that, and they said, go do more research and then come back. And they came back and after having done more research, and they said any amount can cause harm to the human body. And so there is no known safe level. But they set levels for exposure based on how much it would cost to take it out of the air. And so that's mostly a calculation about, you know, how 10 to the 6, you know, an additional 1 in a million cancer, you know, and what does it take to get there? Well, that turns out to be way too expensive. So there is a good deal more benzene in the air than is thought comfortable for, you know, thought safe for people to breathe. Other stuff. Yes?
And other than Lafayette, people in that area and Erie and Longmont are now having themselves tested for volatile organic compounds because they're trying to figure out what the baseline is.
Yes.
As the fracking is going crazy. And it does. That they're much more susceptible to any of these things that come through that are, I guess we get tougher as we get older, maybe. So I mean, it's a constant, for me, the same as you're saying, how do you get through, how do you acknowledge, how do you get through the anger, and how do you work with what is, but not be content?
Yes, absolutely. Well, for example, you know, the case that we have going up in Greeley with the Bella Romero Middle School, the Colorado law now says, in terms of setbacks, that you can't have an oil and gas operation that is within less than 1,000 feet of a school building. So the ONG operation out there is more than 1,000 feet from the school building. Okay, it's not more than 1,000 feet from the school yard where the kids go out to play. And when they're out playing, is when their lungs are functioning most vigorously, when they're breathing the most deeply, and when they're exchanging oxygen at a much higher rate than they do otherwise. There's a bill before the state legislature now that would change the law, that would say 1,000 feet setback from school grounds, which would provide, you know, at least some greater degree of safety. And it's going to probably clear the House, and probably it's going to die in the Senate. And so what that points the way toward is having a real close look at who's running for election this fall and who is financing them and how it might be possible to bring people into office who care enough about the well-being of those children to do something about it. There's a case before the Colorado Supreme Court right now on the question of, you know, the statutory mandate for the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission says, well, you need to take a lot of things into account when you're deciding whether or not to permit an operation. You know, the impact it's going to have on the environment, the profitability of the oil and gas industry, the health and well-being of the population, you know, public health and safety, right? It doesn't specify which of those is the most important. And so there is a lawsuit brought by some teenagers here in Boulder, the Martinez decision that's gone up to the Colorado Court of Appeals, where they said, no, COGCC, when you're making these decisions, your primary obligation needs to be the health and safety of the people of Colorado, and everything else comes second. And so we've been trying to get them to abide by that ruling. Instead, they're challenging it before the Colorado Supreme Court right now. So if the court doesn't support that interpretation, then once again, there's going to need to be an amendment to the statute. And whether that happens or not depends on who's in the Colorado legislature. And so, you know, I don't want to get the Insight Meditation community of Colorado, you know, in a jam with the IRS in terms of telling you who to vote for, but in terms of a civic lessons, that's how it works. You know, you want people making decisions on our behalf who are aligned with our values. And so you just need to invest, regardless of what party you belong to or whether they belong to any party or not. Find out who funds them. Find out whether their values align with yours in terms of, you know, the way they would use their power when they get in office, you know. Supporting people that that want to care for each other, that want to care for our Earth, you know, is certainly, you know, what I do as a citizen. Okay? But it's not for me to tell anyone else what to do. But that's basically how the government works, you know. It depends on the people who are in positions of leadership, what does and does not happen. If enough people feel strongly enough about the need to take care of ourselves through our institutions of government, it will eventually happen. All right, well, we've gone... There are multiple there are multiple interpretations of the language in Genesis. You know, one is the, you know, some emphasize the whole realm of sort of dominion, which means we have sort of absolute despotic control. Others tend to more focus more. If you look at the King James Version of the Bible, the language they use there, and they talk about the obligation of humans and care for the garden, he said, that you are to dress and keep it. That's the language that was used in Old England around the time that the Bible was first translated into English to describe the obligations of the staff of an estate toward the lord of the manor, which is to say, it's your duty to take care of the place, you know, whether it's the gameskeepers or the gardeners or the farmers. You know, it's your obligation to continue to ensure that the estate is bountiful and intact. Bit of a different take. And that being said, I think we've gone on, you know, blown away another good, perfectly good 2 hours. And so we need to go our separate ways.
Do a very brief dedication.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Oh, okay. Yeah. So let's find our sitting posture once more, real quick. May we all live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we all be happy. May we all be peaceful. May we all be free. All beings who walk the earth and live within it, all beings who fly in the skies above and swim in the waters below, all beings both seen and unseen, all beings in all the realms of existence, all beings now alive and all beings yet to be born. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free. May the merits of our practice be devoted to the well-being of all sentient beings. May we go forth knowing that we are one, that we are they and they are we, that there is no separation, and thus that our merit is boundless.